Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. The immensity of space, the distances to stars and galaxies measured in hundreds to millions and even billions of years in light travel time, has always fascinated me, as has the concept of deep time. It's only been in the last 200 years that geologists have been able to piece together the history of the Earth and the vastness of geologic time based on the correlation of rock layers and fossils, and finally, the ability to use radiometric dating, the atomic clocks locked into Earth's minerals, to nail down the absolute ages for Earth's rocks as well as meteorites and the rocks from the moon brought back by the astronauts. The Earth is 4.6 billion years old, an almost unimaginably long time. And during that time, there have been many Earths with different configurations of land masses and oceans and very different atmospheres and climates. Our guest and guide to understand Earth and climate history is Marcia Bjornrud. She's a professor of geology at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin. Her new book is Timefulness: How Thinking Like a Geologist Can Help Save the World. It's one of the best primers I've ever read about geologic time and how our atmosphere has evolved over vast spans of time, and of course, how we are changing it with alarming rapidity. It's fun to read and informative, so I invited her to join us, and she does so via Skype from her Wisconsin home. Well, you know, one of the things I'd like to know about is, you grew up in Wisconsin, didn't you?
I did, and I've lived in other places around the world, but I came back. I guess, had a strong sense of place here in the Upper Great Lakes region.
Well, and in your book, you definitely, you know, give us that sense of you understand the geology of place. When did you first start getting interested in the geology? Was it there in Wisconsin growing up?
I think it probably was. As a child, an elementary school child, I do remember going out to the creek bank with my father and looking around for trilobite fossils. And I had an early fascination, I mentioned in the book, with this island that was born off the coast of Iceland in the 60s. It was called Surtse. And I remember quite vividly seeing a film in school of the volcanic eruptions that were partly submarine, with shoots of ash and steam coming out of the ocean, and just being fascinated by that. But I have to say that then subsequent years of middle and high school mediocre science classes had sort of drummed out of me any thought of going into the sciences. And like many people, I had no real exposure to earth science or geosciences as a legitimate academic discipline until I just happened to take an intro geology class in college. So I'm a bit of an accidental geologist and even scientist, because I didn't think of myself as someone who could do science until, again, I just happened into this course, and I feel very lucky that I stumbled upon it.
Yeah, that's really serendipitous. It's unfortunate that our high schools are kind of geared for our college prep type students to take biology, chemistry, physics, but geology is only like in a lower level earth science class. And it's unfortunate.
It sends the wrong message that somehow earth science is not intellectually stimulating or challenging. I would say in an enlightened society, everyone would take earth science. After all, most of us are going to spend our entire lives here on Earth, and it is arguably quite relevant to our existence. But yeah, it's really kind of shocking that there's no AP courses in general in earth science. And most of the college-bound kids wouldn't take the few earth science courses that are offered in most high schools in this country.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because I think young people really are interested in earth science topics. It's just that they don't really get a chance to get exposed to them on a deep level.
Right, and the only upside I can see is that the people who do find the field, like myself and most of our own students, maybe your daughter, who I understand is also a geologist, when they find it, they're absolutely evangelical about it, almost are converted and love it and are really passionate about what they do. So, you know, the people who end up becoming geologists, I think, are really committed to it and really feel fortunate that they found the field.
Yeah, I'm just to be to be fair and accurate, the way she got turned on to it was just lots of family trips into the mountains and exposing her to field geology and my own, you know, rudimentary understanding of things. And then working at Lassen Volcanic National Park as an intern, that really turned her on to geology. And then she had a really good geology instructor at California State University, Chico, and then later on at CSU Fullerton, and then at Colorado State, and she just loved it.
So she was primed.
Yeah. Trips to the mountains go a long way for, you know, building a geological understanding of the world. You know, one of the things I love about your book is just the title itself. It's called Timefulness, and the subtitle is How Thinking Like a Geologist Can Help Save the World. There's two concepts that you bring up, and I'd like you to kind of explain them to us. And I think it's really important because, you know, the underlying theme in your book is how understanding geologic time can help all of us have a deeper understanding and raise our hackles a bit about, you know, the importance of climate change. Is this concept that most of us, or many of us, have of everything is timeless, you know, and ancient, and it's always been this way and it will always be the same, that the earth has this timeless nature to us. And you even mention a wonderful story about being in school and getting a snow day and that kind of timeless feeling you had then. And then this other concept of timefulness, that when you understand the depths of geologic time, it really changes your perspective. Could you just kind of address those two things a bit for us?
Yeah, so the title is a play on a couple of things. Obviously, one is mindfulness, which is in our cultural milieu these days, which emphasizes being in the present. And I wanted to kind of make a little bit of tension with that idea in saying that what we really need if we want to have a deep sense of serene connection to the world is an awareness of not only the present, but our connection to the past and the continuity between past and future. So that was one of the deliberate kind of allusions of the title. And the other, of course, is the timelessness, which is this aspiration that I think goes back to the Greeks of somehow a place somewhat separate from the mundane earthly realm where things do not change, the Platonic ideal of things being unsullied by time. And to me, that's kind of a sterile idea. There's really not too much of interest in things that have no backstory. And so thinking like a geologist is all about understanding how things evolve over time, how they will continue to change into the future, and where we fit into that continuum.
One of the things I really liked about the book was you kind of get us off in this trip that you made. I think it was, 1987 to Norway, a place called Svalbard. And I think is it Kap Lyell, which would be like Cape Lyell. Could you tell us about your first exposure to that place? Because I found that wonderful writing.
Well, my very first awareness of Svalbard was when I was in eighth grade. And I love maps. I always have. And I was looking through our big world atlas at a map of world time zones. And of course, most of the time zones run along lines of longitude vertically on the map. But there were a few places that were colored in a shade of gray. And I looked at the caption on the map legend, and it said these places had no official time. And one of these places was this archipelago in Arctic Norway called Svalbard. And I found that fascinating, that there was a place somehow that had escaped being sort of shackled by measures of time. So Svalbard first entered my consciousness then. And then, as it happened, I ended up doing my PhD work in geology on Svalbard and went there for three summers in the 80s. And then subsequently, I've been back quite a few more times. I found out that the no official time designation had to do with a dispute between the Russian and Norwegian governments about whether to use Norway time or Moscow time in the archipelago. So it was nothing quite as romantic as I had envisioned. But the place really is a world apart, and until recently felt like it had been left behind by time. And sadly, now, in the last couple of decades, time has caught up with Svalbard, and we've seen huge changes in the ice sheets and the glaciers there. So it is no longer time exempt.
Yeah, you described that later in your story about going back there. I think it was in 2007, and it, you can really feel it in your writing that, you know, this place has changed dramatically from when you were there before.
Yeah, it was really a shock, you know, in a very visceral, personal way that I hadn't expected. I mean, I knew intellectually that things probably would have changed, but there's something about knowing a place so intimately, you know, developing an almost personal relationship with it, and then revisiting it and seeing it so diminished, that was really devastating.
I had a similar experience. I visited Paradise, California yesterday, and I'm sure you're aware of that's the place that the Great Fire destroyed in November, on November 8th. I grew up there, and I know it intimately. One of the things I found fascinating was accounts from police officers that they found it difficult navigating around Paradise because, you know, so much has been destroyed. I didn't find that difficult at all because I know the place so well, and I was able to, you know, seek out all of my childhood haunts and homes that were all gone. But there was that feeling of like, oh my God, you know, I haven't been here in about 20 years and spent a lot of time here, and I spent a lot of time there yesterday. And it was a similar feeling of, you know, the destruction of this place and the change that that fire wrought on it. It was just overwhelming.
And, you know, so sudden and shocking. I can't imagine.
Yeah, well, that's one of the more rapid effects of climate change. And we'll talk about some of those kinds of things later. One of the things that I found really it helped me a lot in my understanding of geologic time is I remember taking a geologic history, a historical geology class. And I really enjoyed that because for the first time I started to understand that when you look at like the rock layers in the Grand Canyon, you know, what you're really seeing is like oceans coming in and receding and beach lines changing over time, and started to really understand that, you know, the rocks tell a story about those changes of cataclysms and long periods of quiet, you know, followed by periods of great drama. And you tell the story of the great early geologists, especially Charles Lyell. And I think his book is what, The Principles of Geology, right?
Right.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us and we'll get back to my conversation with geologist Marcia Bjornroot as we talk about deep time. And we're back. Let's return now to our visit with Lawrence University geologist Marcia Bjornroot. She's the author of the new book, Timefulness. And the idea of uniformitarianism, that the things that we observe today are the same geologic processes that have gone on forever. And all through the book, you bring up Lyell as you discuss that, you know, there are times when there's another thing at work that used to be called catastrophism. Could you talk a little bit about Lyell's view and our modern geologic view?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Lyell was truly a towering figure in the early days of geology, and his Principles of Geology, which is actually a three-volume, huge encyclopedic thing, was very influential in shaping thinkers, including Darwin, who brought at least the first volume with him on the voyage of the Beagle. Without Lyell's thinking about how incremental changes over long periods of time could shape landscapes, Darwin arguably would not have come up with his theory of evolution by natural selection. So, you know, absolutely important in shaping 19th century thinking about not only geologic processes, but evolution and biologic processes too. But I think Lyell's constant harping on the slowness of geologic processes created a kind of blinkered thinking for geologists for many, many decades, probably arguably into the 1980s, when the Alvarez father and son pair, Lewis and Walter Alvarez, first proposed the idea that the dinosaur extinction event had been caused not by some slow environmental change, but instead by an asteroid, as almost everyone knows now. That was really finally the end of strict Lyellian uniformitarianism and the recognition that in some ways it's not anti-uniformitarian to sometimes have catastrophes invoked as explanations for geologic processes. All that uniformitarianism really means is that the physics and the chemistry, those processes that underlie geologic processes haven't changed. But that isn't to say that sometimes the geological events aren't catastrophic. They just, they don't violate the uniformity of physics and chemistry, but they have many different tempos, some slow, some unimaginably violent and sudden.
Yeah, like the end of the Cretaceous, the end of the age of the dinosaurs. And it's interesting, you brought back a flood of memories for me when I was reading about that. Is when I was taking that historical geology class, I remember I was also taking a class called Earth Science 100. It was the writing requirement class for my geosciences degree. And I decided to write about the Alvarez hypothesis. Now, my astronomy professor, who was Dr. James Regas at the time at CSU Chico, was very supportive of me researching this and thought it was great and loved my paper. The historical geology guy thought it was like a bunch of crap, that he was not accepting this new, you know, idea that an asteroid had caused the end of the dinosaurs. And as you point out in the book, it's not as simple as just an asteroid hit the book. There's a lot of complex things that happened to end the age of the dinosaurs. Could you just address that a little bit?
Right. And let me just say that you're absolutely right. At first, probably for 6 or 7 years after the 1980 publication of the Alvarez paper in Science, many geoscientists really disliked it for a variety of reasons. It was non-Lyellian in their minds. It just was against the rules that they had been trained under. But also, the elder Alvarez was not as diplomatic as he might have been toward paleontologists who had been studying the extinction for years, called paleontologists' stamp collectors, which wasn't particularly flattering. So there were a variety of reasons that many people did not accept it. And also, there wasn't a crater that was found for a full 10 years after they first proposed the idea. So that period from about 1980 to 1990 is fascinating to read now in retrospect, and how people finally came somewhat grudgingly in the geosciences to accept the idea. But now, maybe 30 years out or more from the original paper, we are seeing that maybe it's not such a simple story. Certainly a large asteroid struck the Earth. We know where the crater was. It just happened that the rocks probably were bad ones to have been struck. They were a combination of carbonate rocks that released a lot of long-trapped carbon dioxide, as well as some evaporitic rocks, meaning rocks left by ancient evaporating salty water that included sulfates like gypsum, and their volatilization and the impact could have caused acid rain in a big way and caused short-term cooling before a longer-term warming because of all the CO2.
It's like so many things that we learn about in life, about the Earth and the universe, it's not just a binary thing. There's lots of complexity to real understanding.
Yes, and I think to become a geologist means you have to have a kind of tolerance for complicated explanations. It's very rarely something that's neat and tidy and clean and resolved.
Yeah, you don't just get to plug numbers into an equation and, you know, out pops the answer.
Right. And it really does take a certain kind of personality. I've had some students who, came into the science and realized, no, they like the precision, say, of theoretical physics. And we can't offer that. It's, you know, the Earth is old and big and complicated and messy.
And yeah, and we don't have a really great record of the early Earth. One of the things I always loved as a kid was maps, just like you, and the geologic timescale. I remember seeing that many, many times. And first time, I think, was in a museum of natural history. And then I had one on my wall as a kid. And of course, it starts with, there's a little block at the bottom called the Precambrian. And then below that, 4.6 billion years. And then above that is all this stuff. The Paleozoic and then the Mesozoic and Cenozoic and all of that, which looks like all of the Earth's history is those three blocks of time. And one of the things that you point out in your book is the time before that is really huge and important.
It's 8/9 of Earth's history. It's most of the story. And if nothing else, I hope that people get from my book the idea that we need to really reconceive our kind of geography of time. And I certainly emphasize that when I teach history of Earth and life. We spend almost proportional amounts of time on this so-called Precambrian as the post-Cambrian, we could say. But that dichotomy is really an artifact of Victorian times when fossils were the only way we could calibrate geologic time. And below the bottom of the Cambrian rocks at the base of the Paleozoic era, there really weren't visible macrofossils. And so everything was just lumped as Precambrian. And it's a real misnomer because it's most of Earth's story.
Yeah, and that's what's so deceiving when you look at those charts. It just looks like, oh yeah, well, there's that. And then all this other stuff looks so much more interesting. I wonder if you could maybe, I'll ask you about each part, and you could just kind of give us a primer on the Precambrian, because I find this just fascinating. It starts with the birth of the Earth 4.6 billion years ago, and an eon called the Hadean. Could you tell us a bit about what was going on with planet Earth during that time?
Right, and that time, named for Hades, is defined technically as the time for which we have no actual rock record on Earth, and we know it primarily from meteorites, so extraterrestrial rocks, from moon rocks, from the few chunks of Mars that have happened to find their way to Earth. They're actually Martian meteorites that have been found, and possibly even a couple of rocks from Venus.
Wow.
So that has been pieced together, and it's an interesting time because we actually have very high resolution information about the very earliest stages of the solar system. And then from meteorites mainly, but that record kind of turns off at about 4.4 billion years. And then we have this long, quiet time. All we have are moon rocks and a few Earth crystals, not rocks per se, but just millimeter-sized crystals.
Those are the zircons?
Right, that were preserved in a sandstone in Australia. So not in their original rock, but eroded fragments of some very ancient rock that happened to survive and happened to be found by geologists and dated isotopically and then also analyzed to death geochemically so that we can make some inferences about a very, very early crust that must have existed on Earth about 4.4 billion years ago.
Where do we find the oldest rocks, like, for example, in the United States?
The oldest rocks in the U.S. are actually in Minnesota. In the Minnesota River Valley of southern Minnesota. So Mankato is a town people might have heard of, or Austin, that's where Spam comes from. and they are Archean rocks, about 3.7 billion years old. And at one time were thought to be the oldest rocks. But then older ones have been subsequently discovered in Greenland, for example, in Australia, and the record holders now for probably indefinitely are about a 4 billion year sequence in the Northwest Territories area in Canada up near the Slave Lake, Great Slave Lake.
And how much longer after that is the first evidence we have that there was life on Earth?
Not that long, geologically speaking. So again, these acastonices up near the Great Slave Lake are 4 billion. And in Greenland, we have the oldest rocks that actually record surface processes. So the ones in Canada are very old, but they form deep in the subsurface. So they're not telling us anything about what was going on at the surface of the Earth. But the very oldest rocks that have any record of surface processes, in the ones in Greenland, are about 3.8 billion, and they seem to have vestigial evidence of photosynthetic life forms. So that's pretty extraordinary. When we look at the moon, we know that as late as about 3.8 billion years ago, the moon was still being bombarded fiercely by large meteorites, leaving the huge lunar maria craters. And so it would have been a pretty inhospitable setting for life on Earth. We presume we were being hit just as frequently as the moon. But it appears that life was already making its way that early.
And what would the Earth's atmosphere be like during this time?
Well, 3.8 billion years ago, we certainly would not have had any free oxygen in the atmosphere. We have good evidence for that. We can look at minerals that were precipitated out of the sea, which would have been in equilibrium with the atmosphere, and we can tell that there was very little oxygen in the ocean water. The best evidence for that is that there are minerals like uranium oxides that today are dissolved almost immediately upon encountering oxygen that could exist as sediments rolling around in streams in early Precambrian time. We don't have that. Or pyrite, which might be more familiar to people today. If you think about it, you would almost never see pyrite as a sand grain in a stream bed, because as soon as pyrite is exposed to oxygen, it essentially rusts and becomes iron oxide and crumbles away. So there are mineralogical indicators of oxygen levels that tell us pretty clearly there was no free oxygen until maybe about 2.5 billion years ago.
And you out there, noble listener, probably know pyrite as good old fool's gold, the little flecks of golden stuff you see on the top of the sand and streams, which lets you know it can't possibly be gold because it's, you know, light enough to sit on top of the sand.
And it might sit there for a little while, but it wouldn't get preserved in the long haul and be locked into the geologic record in the presence of oxygen.
And you also talk about this period of time that's called the Boring Billion. I love that name, the Boring Billion. Can you bore us with a bit about the Boring Billion?
Well, it has that misnomer because the two things that bookend it are great upheavals. So I guess maybe I need to tell what the bookends are before I can explain why it's boring. So the beginning of the Proterozoic Eon, which is the last big chapter in the Precambrian, and in fact, almost half of Earth's history, was the Great Oxidation Event. That was the rise of oxygen, which is recorded by the precipitation of the great banded iron formations that we have up here in the Lake Superior region, when iron, which had been a very abundant element in seawater, came rusting out of the seas in large volumes, leaving behind the iron ores that really have been the source for all the steel ever manufactured in the world.
And it was microorganisms it was the photosynthetic organisms that allowed that to happen, right?
That's right. Yeah, it was life that changed the atmosphere. And this great oxidation event wasn't a single moment. It actually transpired over hundreds of millions of years. But it's a very distinctive time in the biogeochemistry of the Earth. We don't have banded iron formation forming anymore, because as soon as iron is introduced into the oceans, mainly by submarine volcanoes like at Black Smokers in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, it rusts out right near those submarine volcanoes. So this is a one-time event and a rock type that's extinct in a sense. Then we go into the rest of the Proterozoic, and we think for a long time the oceans were partly oxygenated. There's a lot of controversy in the scientific literature about what exactly the chemistry of the Proterozoic oceans was. The older thinking was that once we crossed that threshold of the oxygen revolution, everything was kind of like it is today. But current thinking is we went through a long period where we had a kind of stratified ocean, and the deeper oceans still weren't fully oxygenated. Maybe only the shallow parts were, where the photosynthetic algae would have been living. And then for about a billion years, between about 1.8 and 800 million years ago, so 1.8 billion and 800 million years, that's the boring billion, where there was a remarkable period of biogeochemical stability. And to call it boring, I think, is a disservice, because it suggests that the Earth somehow was kind of in this remarkable steady state with inputs and outputs balanced, the climate fairly stable for an extraordinarily long period of time. And then the other bookend of that time is the great snowball Earth event, where for perhaps poorly understood reasons, we entered a very deep ice age that lasted, again, not just for a few tens of thousands of years like the ice age we're just coming out of, but tens of millions of years.
Yeah, the so-called snowball Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's interesting to think about that climatic stability. You know, I wish we could have a boring decade at least.
Exactly. Something to be emulated, I think.
Yeah, and one of the lessons to learn from Earth history is these changes, that these long periods of stability and then these periods of change. Could you talk about some of the periods of the greatest climatic change that we've been able to deduce from the geologic record?
Well, certainly Snowball Earth is right up there, probably the greatest climate catastrophe that we've been able to reconstruct in deep time. It was a deep freeze. There's good evidence from Svalbard, as well as many other places around the world, that there were glaciers at sea level at the equator. So there are ways that we can tell if rocks were laid down, in a marine environment, that would indicate very low altitude. But we can also often determine their latitudes. And so this was a really deep ice age. And exactly why it happened, again, is fodder for many, many, many scientific papers. It seems to have been a combination of the configuration of the continents at the time and lots of feedback mechanisms that caused what might have started as a minor ice age to become this really deep freeze. And then how we got out of it is also a matter of controversy. It must have been that finally greenhouse gases built up to the point where even on a very reflective, nearly completely ice and snow-covered planet, greenhouse warming just overwhelmed the reflectivity of the planet and warmed things up, perhaps really suddenly. So that's an extreme climate oscillation that's fascinating. And there's just a new paper out this week, actually, in the PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy, arguing that the Great Unconformity in the Grand Canyon, and in fact, it's a great unconformity here in Wisconsin as well, this discontinuity between Precambrian and Cambrian rocks, is probably a record of that snowball Earth time. And in that paper, they're arguing that several miles of rock may have been removed by the glaciations of the snowball Earth event, and left in many places this gap in the geologic record that we call the Great Unconformity. So I think that in my mind, that's the most extreme. There have been other fluctuations, but that one is really unique in the history of the Earth.
Is that the same thing that we find in the Grand Canyon?
The Great Unconformity, yeah. So when you get down to the bottom of the stratified horizontal rocks and you see the dark Vishnu schists and Zoroaster granite, that contact there between those rock units, that's the Great Unconformity, which represents, let me think, in the Grand Canyon, about 1.2 billion years of unrecorded time.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion of deep time and climate change with geologist Marcia Bjornerud. Professor Bjornerud is the author of the new book, Timefulness. Stay with us.
Thank you.
we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our visit with geologist Marcia Bjornrud from Lawrence University in Wisconsin as we talk about geologic time and climate change. Moving forward through the geologic record, we get into the time when life really starts to go through lots of evolutionary changes, which brings me to something I don't know if I want to ask you about this, but I will. For a geology professor, do you run into many students that have a kind of a creationism, young earth creationism especially, kind of bent when they come to you? And how do you deal with that?
I occasionally do. I'll say that I used to teach at Miami University in Southern Ohio, and I would encounter it more often there. But I sometimes have students who truly are struggling with the faith that they've been brought up in. And my response is that I'm here to teach you the logic of geology and not to challenge your faith, but just to explain the methods and the observations that we can make. And I sometimes do use a kind of argument that I've borrowed from Descartes, which is as follows, that if you're a believing person and believe that there was a creator who made the world, you have kind of two options once you start understanding the rock record. You can either accept that there was an event of creation very, very long time ago, and it's been unfolding since. The world has gone through many iterations and evolutionary changes. Or you must accept the idea that maybe the creator is a deceitful trickster who has planted every evidence of an old earth in every single place we could think to look, from a fossil bed we haven't found yet to a zircon crystal in a sandstone in Australia. And given every appearance that the earth is very old and has a cohesive story, but that is in fact a complete fiction.
Yeah, well, I'll go with the former rather than the latter there.
So that can be hard, and you know, I can't decide for people, but I think it's very important for scientists to be respectful of people's belief systems, because we are not going to make any headway by just being disdainful. And I think for myself that there is an almost spiritual connection that I feel with the earth. The more I understand it, the more that I realize I don't know everything about it. That is a cause for awe and respect of a spiritual kind. And I think maybe we scientists need to convey that a little more. We shouldn't pretend to be complete dispassionate observers of what we study. Many of us are in the sciences because we really feel deep connection to the creation. And if we conveyed that a little more clearly, maybe we would win over people who otherwise would not be open to the scientific worldview.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and something that we all need to respect each other's, especially belief systems, and a lot of times there's ways that they can coexist, and you can still, you know, you can still believe in God and see, you know, that the creation event of the Big Bang, for example, is pretty supernatural by just description itself. And then, you know, just, you got to look at the way the earth is, not the way, you know, you want it to fit into some story.
Yeah. And I think there's real hypocrisy in people who absolutely refuse to believe the modern geological understanding of the age of the earth and earth's history, in being, they benefit from discoveries geologists make, including oil and gas and mineral resources. All of these are based on a clear understanding of how to read the rock record and understanding the ages of rocks and the stratigraphy of the sediments that oil and gas, for example, come out of. So to me, I sometimes uncharitably have the view, well, you can have your young earth, but then you should not benefit from the fruits of geologic thinking.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to the big theme of your book, which is climate change. And let's talk about the era that we're in now, which is called tell us about the Anthropocene.
Right. Anthropocene or Anthropocene. I don't think that the pronunciation is stabilized yet. The idea, and it isn't officially accepted as a geological time interval yet. But the idea is that we are now in a time where humans are geologic agents of the first order, that we are on par with things like volcanoes in being agents of atmospheric change, with rivers in being agents of erosion, with past cataclysms in being causes of mass extinction. So there are so many ways we are altering the Earth system at rates that are quite extreme and in some cases possibly unprecedented in the geologic record as we know it. So that's the idea. And it's gained a lot of currency both in kind of popular imagination and it's used in scientific discourse, although it again hasn't been officially approved as a geologic time interval. Some people think it's a self-aggrandizing idea. And to me, that's the wrong way to read this. It's not saying we're in charge now. To the contrary, it's that we're causing damage and change at rates that are potentially going to feed back into changes that are really out of our control. So I don't think it's supposed to be something that's saying humans are now in the driver's seat. It's just a way of putting in perspective the magnitude of our effects on the planet.
And when you talk about the geologic record, you mentioned that there are these markers, or I think you called them golden spikes. Like, for example, at the end of the Cretaceous, when the dinosaur extinction happens, you know, you've got that clay layer in Italy and places like that, where you've got certain layers of rocks that these are the markers of the boundaries between one era and the next, or one period and the next. What would be the marker for this one?
And that's one of the controversies. It's a rather bureaucratic thing, but we do in the geosciences want absolute markers that everyone recognizes as the boundaries of time intervals. And so for the most recent epoch, which is the Holocene, which is basically all of human history, the last 10,000 years, that boundary is defined by a layer of ice in Greenland, which is deeply enough buried that our Anthropocene climate change shouldn't affect it. But that probably isn't going to be true if we choose an ice layer for the bottom of the Anthropocene, because the rates of melting of ice are so extreme that it could be gone. So there's a lot of controversy about how in the geologic record to define this. Some people say, well, we can just define it as a particular calendar year, but that would make it a little bit different from other geologic time intervals. I don't really have skin in this game. I feel like it's a rather academic argument about something whose meaning is more important than the definition of exactly where it might start or how it might be recorded in the rock record.
Yeah, I even saw one place where it was, you could start it at the first atomic tests.
Mm-hmm. Which is something that you can find right now in, say, Antarctic ice. That's a well-recorded horizon. But will that be around in a couple of centuries?
Yeah, who knows? When we look at what's going on during, if you want to call it the Anthropocene or whatever, the big event is the amount of carbon dioxide that we are increasingly putting into the atmosphere. We're up above 400 parts per million now. And you make an interesting case when you talk about what are some of the ways we can deal with this. Could you just talk about briefly some of the possible geoengineering solutions and other ways that we can go about, you know, trying to reverse this process while we, you know, do the very difficult task of weaning ourselves off fossil fuels, because that's like trying to turn a super tanker around. It's very difficult.
Yeah, I do want to emphasize the best thing we can do is wean ourselves as soon as we can and take advantage of low-hanging fruit, like better fuel efficiency and better insulation and capping oil and gas wells from leaking. But we can also perhaps do some other more active carbon sequestration technologies. There have been lots of different proposals ranging from just reforestation, which can be an interim solution over decade to century kinds of scales. Some people I know are experimenting with a rather arcane type of rock called peridotite, which is made of the mineral olivine, whose gem form is peridot. People may know It's the August birthstone, I think. This is a very major mineral in Earth's mantle, but it's not exposed very much at the surface. There are a few places up in Northern California and Southern Oregon where you have peridotites at the surface. But because it's a mantle rock, it's very reactive with gases in the Earth's atmosphere, especially carbon dioxide, and actually will react pretty quickly with CO2 in the atmosphere to form carbonates like calcite and fix the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in mineral form for the long haul. So this sounds promising, and it could be if you could just somehow find ways to get concentrated CO2 into contact with large expanses of peridotite. But that's the challenge. We don't have peridotite bodies necessarily where we have gas or coal power plants. So I'm not counting on this as being the silver bullet solution anytime soon. Some carbon sequestration technologies of just pumping, capturing CO2 gas from power stations and pumping it underground have shown some limited success, but it's an expensive technology. And unless we have some kind of economic incentives like carbon tax, it's just not going to happen. So photosynthesis is actually a pretty economical solution. In other words, reforestation of areas that we can turn back over into forest land, and in the meantime, just trying as quickly as we can to ramp down our fossil fuel usage.
Yeah, and I'm just, you know, frankly, all these big mega fires we've had out west are also contributing to pumping massive amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Yeah, I've seen some of the estimates. It's a shocking amount of biomass.
It is. When you talk about looking out on a landscape from your home, you had something you said I found quite profound. You said you see many Wisconsins. Could you just tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, it's a habit of mine that you really can't shake once you start doing it. I can't go anywhere without kind of trying to parse what is the story here. But here in Wisconsin, we do have a surprisingly diverse geologic story. People don't think perhaps of the Midwest in that way, but up here on the southern edge of the Canadian Shield, the most recent chapter is, of course, the Ice Age. And so the landscape that I see right out my window here is really a memory of the glaciers that were here just yesterday, geologically speaking. We have moraines and we have great lake basins, an outwash of sand and gravel when the glaciers melted, huge piles of sand and gravel that are used for building roads that were a memory of the melting of the glaciers. And then we have a very rich history of the Paleozoic time when sea level was very high. And so we have marine sedimentary rocks that record a time when Wisconsin was a shallow tropical marine environment, wonderful fossils of coral reefs and organisms that lived in these reef systems. And then as we go deeper, we have a very complete record of this Proterozoic eon, which stretched from about 2.5 billion to about 600 million years ago, when Wisconsin was at a series of plate boundaries. So we have volcanoes that are analogous to the Cascades today. We have a great mountain belt that is no longer topographically expressed, but we can see the eroded roots of this mountain belt. It was probably equivalent to the Appalachians. And we have a great rift zone that created the basin of what is now Lake Superior, something analogous to the East African Rift today. So we have a record of all the major types of plate boundaries that we can see in the world today in the bedrock of Wisconsin. So there have been many, many iterations of Wisconsin, and all of them I feel are with me. I almost feel that they're rooms that I can go into and visit when we go on field trips with students. I'm going back to these places in time.
Yeah, it's almost like you have the ability to time travel because of your understanding of reading that landscape.
It does feel that way sometimes, and I have almost a great irrational yearning to see the landscape as it was in those times. But in the mind's eye, you can do that.
Well, as we move into the future, the big takeaway for me when I look at these issues is I hear this all the time from people who are climate deniers or they just don't know very much. They say, well, the climate's always been changing. And then a good friend of mine who is a meteorologist said, yeah, but speed kills. It's the rate of change that is going on right now that's truly alarming.
It's the rate of change, and we fool ourselves by thinking that we are, we think we're more resilient and flexible than we are. I mean, if you think of the disruption that is caused by a few storms like Katrina or Harvey, or some of the hurricanes in the last couple of years, and how much we say they cost us, these are small things. We're talking about decades of inexorable, unpredictable weather events and drought events and ridiculously heavy rain events that are not what we're expecting. And that's the problem, that yes, of course, the Earth has been through all kinds of changes, but for most of Earth's history, we haven't been around. And the Holocene, the last 10,000 years over which human civilizations have really developed, has been an unusually stable time. And we've come to count on that stability. So that's the fallacy in that argument. Yeah, I like that speed kills. It's absolutely true. But it's also that we assume things are going to be the way they always have been. And that's not going to be the case if we're changing the geochemical rules. And we're not going to like it. It's not about saving the planet. It's about saving, in the subtitle of my book, the world is not the Earth. It's the infrastructure that we've come to count on in the Western world we know, that we assume will always be here. It's not going to be the same when we're spending more and more money every year mopping up after disasters.
Yeah. Thank you for your time today. And I want to thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us on this program. It was really a delight talking to you, Marcia.
It was lots of fun, Dave. Thank you.
Thanks again to our guest, Marcia Bjornrud. Her new book, Timefulness, How Thinking Like a Geologist Can Save the World, from Princeton University Press, is available at major booksellers. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. You can listen to this and past episodes at mynspr.org. Be sure to subscribe to our podcasts, Blue Dot, on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We're distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz, and The Dot is produced by Mr. Sky Schoolfield. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.